This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just over 2 hours ago, with the sun peeking through the winter clouds, George W. Bush raised his right hand and swore for a second time to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution as the President of the United States. Despite talk of a big domestic agenda in his second term, President Bush spent only a few moments talking about that. Instead, in a speech relatively brief by historical standards, he hammered home one point.
There is only one force of history that can break the reign of hatred and resentment and expose the pretensions of tyrants and reward the hopes of the decent and tolerant, and that is the force of human freedom. We are led by events and common sense to one conclusion. The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands. The best hope for peace in our world is the expansion of freedom in all the world.
President Bush used the words freedom and liberty over and over again in this address. Indeed, in a little more than 21 minutes, he used freedom 20 times, liberty 15. This hour, we'd like your thoughts about the speech and about the day's events. Was it an appropriate speech for a country at war? For that matter, was it eloquent? Was it a unifier or a divider? Give us a call. We have two lines today, one for Republicans, the other for Democrats. If you're a Republican or lean Republican and like to join the conversation, our number is 800-344-3893. If you're a Democrat or lean Democratic, 800-344-3864. That's 800-344-3893 for Republicans, and for Democrats, 800-344-3864. We'll get to your calls in just a moment, but first, let's check in with NPR's Andrea Seabrook, who's at the Capitol. Andrea, good to speak with you.
Hi, Neil.
The lunch after the inaugural address is a traditional event, and everybody gathers there for, well, quite a meal.
Yes, the most powerful in Washington, Washington officialdom, around beautifully placed velvet jacquard draped tables. I mean, it's just gorgeous. Etched glass, etched crystal goblets, and gold-plated silverware, eating the most wonderful food that is supposed to reckon from have something to do with the home state of the president today. It's quail in huckleberry glaze and a few other things. It's just a beautiful thing. Unfortunately, mostly closed to press and cameras at this point, but the president is preparing to come out of the east front of the Capitol. Of course, the Capitol building has no back. It has two fronts. He'll come out the east front to review members of the military services, review troops out there in the east front before he boards his motorcade for the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue.
Of course, you can't gather that many important people anywhere in Washington, D.C. just for a meal. They have to talk, too. Anything interesting said during this luncheon, Andrea?
That's true. Among the speakers at this luncheon are Trent Lott, who was the chairman of the Joint Congressional Committee on Inaugural Ceremonies. He's also a senator from Mississippi. House Speaker Dennis Hastert, both of them presented Vice President Cheney and President Bush with several gifts at the luncheon, including a pair of etched crystal hurricane lamps from Lennox. Also, President Bush spoke again, and Vice President Cheney also gave speeches, and they were both toasted as well.
Did the president speak?
The president, I am not entire. I believe he has spoken or is just about to speak at the luncheon.
Okay. And, of course, after that wraps up, then the inaugural parade begins, and floats and bands have been assembling for quite some time on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue. That's going to be quite an event as well. Andrea Seabrook, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Andrea Seabrook with us from the Capitol building. President Bush's speech earlier today underwent more than 20 revisions, What will history remember about the president's performance today? Well, here to help us sort through the rhetoric is Ken Kechigian, a chief speechwriter for former President Ronald Reagan. He's currently an attorney in the Los Angeles firm Smiland and Kechigian. He's with us by phone from his office in L.A., and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello, thank you.
So what did you think about the speech today? How do you think it'll be remembered?
Well, I think it'll be remembered years to come as a speech that, largely for its words rather than the presentation of today. What I mean is it wasn't not that the presentation was bad, but the occasion itself will be overcome by the actual words that survive as almost as a literature, as American literature. I viewed the speech. I've read through it several times now, and it reminds me of a little bit of how I viewed Lincoln's second inaugural when I was working on President Reagan's first, and that is, it's hard to read it out loud. It's a lot easier to read, and President Bush's speech today is an extremely literate essay on America, and that's how I think it'll be remembered over the years as it becomes it goes into the textbooks.
Lincoln's second inaugural, of course, is the one against every other inaugural address is measured, and boy, that's hard to live up to. But
they all fail, believe me. It's poetry beyond poetry, and it's that's how I thought today's speech was. It's almost like the difference between hearing poetry read out loud and reading it, and the words are the sentences in today's speech are so elegantly structured that in the rereading, you sort of wonder if that's what you heard.
The president laid out some bold ambitions in this speech. And first and foremost, the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
I think that presidents, to keep their place in history and to make a difference, need to do things boldly. And President Reagan liked to refer to his ideas as being bold colors, not pale pastels. And there are some extremely broad and assertions in the speech, but I think that's great. I think it's a president who determines that he's going to take charge and make a difference in the world. But I had another view about the speech, too, and that is that it's almost like it would qualify as an essay in the Federalist Papers 200 years ago. Or more than 200 years ago, it becomes the defining premise for America, is what he set out to do, it's chewing off a lot, but I like the concept because it's almost like creating a new standard for the country.
Interesting. A lot of people say that in the age of television, inauguration speeches have been, altered by the fact that instead of speaking to a relatively well-educated elite there on the steps of the Capitol, you're speaking to the nation, indeed the world. You're saying this was more like a pre-television speech.
It is in my mind, because I think the words will survive a lot longer than the occasion. And now, President Reagan, in 1981, the first draft of the speech he thought was a little too eloquent in his words. In other words, it was a little too fancy, I think, for him. And he put it down into more structural, short, declarative sentences with where the ideas flowed in the presentation itself, but I think this speech to me was almost more 1776 than Crawford 2005.
A question that we raised on the program last week when we were looking ahead to this speech, do you think that this was a come-together address or a follow-me speech?
Oh, I think it's both. I think it's come-together because only if we're together can we do these bold things, and if as you come together, I will be your leader. I think it's a combination. I think that's the finest in presidential leadership, very frankly, is someone who can assert himself at the head of the pack, at the same time convince people that our best success comes by when combining values and the resources of people's minds.
We want to get, of course, listeners involved in the program. We have two lines today for Republicans. It's 800-344-3893. For Democrats, 800-344-3864. And let's get our first caller on the line. This is Robin, who joins us from San Diego, California.
Hi.
It's on the Democratic line. Go ahead, Robin.
Well, I don't really understand what President Bush feels, what freedom really means, because I feel like there's a lot of people who are, and I don't know, in my mind, I think that the tyranny that he talks about, I think that that's what the United States is. They're causing a lot of tyranny over in Iraq. A lot of people are dying, and nobody's really talking about that. And I'm embarrassed that he uses Christianity to push his crusade.
Ken Kachigian, a response?
Well, I didn't sense that at all that he was trying to create any kind of Christian crusade. I don't know what words I would have picked out that would convey that meaning. But there are 25 million people in Iraq, and 2 years ago there was zero chance that they'd have any freedom whatsoever in a tyrannical regime, and there is infinitely more possibilities now. And I think that's what he was talking to, and people are going to have views. I mean, you could view the fact that hundreds of thousands had died in World War II for a empty cause, but it wasn't empty, and neither, in President's judgment, is this cause. And of course, in my judgment, I feel the same.
And Robin, thank you very much for the call. We just have a couple of seconds left with you, Ken Kachigian. He obviously was speaking of Iraq and Afghanistan as well, but never mentioned them by name.
Well, I think it was obvious what he had in mind. I mean, what struck me in the second paragraph of the speech, he got right to it when he referred to a day of fire. And sequentially, we had Afghanistan, and now the second tier of that would be what's happening in Iraq. And I think he had every reason to put what he was doing, his policies in the Middle East, put that in a historical context, as defined by our past and how it would define our future.
Ken Kachigian, we thank him very much for his time, former speechwriter for President Reagan. More of your calls in a moment. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, where earlier today President Bush took the oath of office for the second time. How are you marking inauguration today? A party? A protest? Maybe it's not just a big deal for you. We want to hear about it. We're using split lines today. The Republican line is 800-344-3893. The Democratic line, 800-344-3864. The email address for everybody, TOTN@NPR.org. Before we get to your calls, we'd like to play one more excerpt from the president's inaugural address, and maybe you'd like to talk about this, too.
In America's ideal of freedom, the public interest depends on private character, on integrity, and tolerance toward others, and the rule of conscience in our own lives. Self-government relies, in the end, on the governing of the self. That edifice of character is built in families, supported by communities with standards, and sustained in our national life by the truths of Sinai, the Sermon on the Mount, the words of the Quran, and the varied faiths of our people. Americans move forward in every generation by reaffirming all that is good and true that came before, ideals of justice and conduct that are the same yesterday, today, and forever.
President George W. Bush speaking today from the west front of the United States Capitol after he took the oath of office for a second time. Let's get another caller up on the line, and this is on the Republican line. Ken joining us from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Good morning.
Good morning where you are. Good afternoon here in Washington.
Ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall, I've been wondering why the U.S. doesn't establish a more idealistic foreign policy, and why we can't move to become evangelists for democracy, and I'd have to say that that's what I heard today in the president's speech.
And it sounds as if you very much approve of that.
I very much approve of it. You know, the president has probably made some mistakes over the past 4 years, but today's speech made me proud that I was supporting him and proud to meet America.
I wonder what you made of the phrase that he used, America will not pretend that jailed dissidents prefer their chains, that women welcome humiliation and servitude, or that any human being aspires to live at the mercy of bullies.
Well, I think that everywhere, people deserve to be ruled by people who govern with the consent of the governed. And in the past, because of the Cold War, we've had to tolerate and even befriend people who did not rule with the consent of their citizens. But that should be not something that we continue to tolerate.
Ideals are often sound wonderful. Sometimes are difficult to put into practice. Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Egypt, all important allies of the United States. Those countries would seem to be directly challenged by some of the things the president was saying today.
Well, we can't rule the entire world, and we can't probably put into place these ideas by fiat. But what we can do is work in that direction. For example, the president could confer some kind of special honor to visitors to the White House who rule with consent of the governed and to promote liberty and freedom in their own countries.
Ken, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Well, viewers shiver out in the cold along Pennsylvania Avenue today. Temperatures hovering right around the freezing mark. The office building around them play host to a long-held Washington inaugural tradition, elite viewing parties. In conference rooms and corner offices along that route, employees and their guests have some of the best seats for the spectacle. We're joined now by Steve Bohm, an executive partner with the law firm of Sutherland, Asbill & Brennan. Nice of you to join us today.
My pleasure. Good afternoon.
How's the party going?
Party's going great. We got 1,000 folks here, clients, friends, partners, associates, and employees. We're enjoying a celebration of America today.
So this sounds like a big event for the firm as well.
It's a great event for the firm, and we're always surprised and delighted just how many of our friends come here from quite a distance to enjoy the celebration. Sometimes we in Washington take a lot for granted, but it's a wonderful day for us.
There must be something of a bragging right for various companies. Once every 4 years, you get to have those great seats. It must be important for your clients as well.
I think it is. It's a wonderful perk. We're here on the northeast corner of Pennsylvania Avenue. We see 15 people deep right outside the building, and we're a little warmer than they are, and we have a few more crab cakes, and we're very fortunate.
I wonder, much of downtown Washington, D.C., about 100 blocks, in fact, were cut off, surrounded by Jersey barriers today for security purposes. Was it hard getting to work?
It was actually not hard getting in today. Surprisingly, I think the police and the soldiers have done a fantastic job, at least on our checkpoint here on 13th Street. They whisked us right through with a little bit of a pat down for excitement, but it was fine. It's all gone splendidly so far.
Stephen Bohm, thanks very much. Have a good time.
Thank you.
Stephen Bohm, an executive partner with the Washington law firm of Sutherland, Asbill & Brennan, and he was with us from their offices on Pennsylvania Avenue. Let's get another caller on the line, and back on the Democratic line, and we'll talk with Karen, who's with us from San Francisco.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air, Karen.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say that I think that Bush's presidency will continue to be a divisive presidency. I think he's a my way or the highway kind of man, and while he is bold, I think that boldness that's not tempered with wisdom or the ability to listen to diverse points of view becomes tyranny. And I think that's very dangerous.
And you heard, I suspect you did not hear then much in the way of reaching out to American allies.
No. No, I didn't. And I've done quite well. Yeah, no, I did not.
And nevertheless, the goal of liberating people from tyranny, that can't be something that Americans oppose.
No, it can't be something that Americans oppose. But, you know, I mean, I think inserting our idea of what liberty means on parts of the world that may have very different points of view and cultural experiences is pretty naive, really. I'm a documentary photographer. I've done an enormous amount of traveling in Africa and other parts of the world. And, you know, societies need to develop in their own way.
Yet the president, I think, specifically said that our vision of democracy and freedom is not everybody's vision. Everybody must find their own voice.
Yeah, but he's not behaving that way, is he?
Karen, thanks very much for the phone call.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
115 groups are participating in the inaugural parade today, from the Citadel's Summerall Guards to Washington's own Ballou High School Marching Band. Both those groups get to wear long coats and pants. The Kilgore College Rangerettes are not so lucky. Joining us now from the parade route is their choreographer and assistant director, Shelley Wayne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
For the marching bands and color guards in today's parade, this weather must be a little painful.
It's a little chilly, but, you know, we were here the last time and 4 years ago, and this time's a little bit warmer, so we're quite thankful for that.
I must remember I was outside 4 years ago, and it was plenty cold then.
It certainly was.
Where are you in the parade process now?
Well, we have just been moved from the warming tents. We are outside in our first holding area, and we'll just continue to move until we get to the entry point of the parade.
It must seem like forever that you're waiting.
Well, you know, it's a long process, but it's all important in the effort of keeping everyone secure, and we're, of course, very thankful for that.
Tell us a little bit about the Rangerettes.
Oh, I'd be happy to. The Rangerettes are the first dancing drill team created in the world. They were created in 1940 by a Texan named Gussie Nell Davis, and we've been in existence since then. We are, of course, known widely throughout the state of Texas, but all across the United States. We've had the fortune of traveling all across the world to represent our college, our state, and our country. So we're quite proud to do that, serving as ambassadors, we like to call ourselves.
Obviously, this is at least your second inaugural. Have you been to others?
Yes, sir. They have. They participated in 1958.
And when do you expect to be stepping out onto Pennsylvania Avenue?
I believe our departure into the parade will be approximately 45 minutes to an hour.
Well, have a great time.
Well, thank you so very much.
Shelley Wayne is assistant director and choreographer of the Kilgore College Rangerettes, who marched today in the inaugural parade. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Harold. Harold's on the
yes.
Republican line from Oakland, California. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, I was so pleased as punch, that the president talked about unity and reaching out across the aisle. But the thing that troubles me are all of those hateful liberals that have been calling in. And my concern is if they won't reach their hand out to us, and if they simply can't, work with us, if they slap our hand, we will not work with them either. Now, there are excellent Democrats like Sal Miller that are willing to work with us. But I cannot deal with the hate of the liberals.
Well, as you know, Harold, people see hatred on both sides. The president did call for unity today, but a lot of Democrats did not hear a lot of reaching out for their issues and the things they care about.
Well, let me tell you, I am steamed about Barbara Boxer's comments about talking about our president and Condoleezza Rice as if they're sexual perverts backing torture and abuse and so forth. And we have worked hard to make the liberals understand that they need to have the proper values, and they just don't get it.
What would you be willing to give as you would reach out to liberals?
Well, to the liberals, I would reach out the truth. We'd be willing to work with them. We would offer to them the proper values. They would be welcome in our churches. They would be welcome in our political circles. But they're being excluded for a good reason from many Republican committees, and that's just because they have to blame the president. They hate us for our freedom, and they hate us for our values. The Democrats hate us for our values. Now, we don't wave a flag and say that all Muslims have no values. But let's be honest about it. The president has a mandate. He no longer has to pretend. Do you see what I mean?
I do, Harold. Thank you very much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's get a caller on the Democratic lineup. This is HB. HB's calling from Whites Creek, Tennessee.
Hello?
Hello, HB. You're on the air.
I'm switching. Okay.
Switching phones.
Okay,
good.
Yeah, the battery died.
I was worried you were switching radio stations there for a while. We frown on that.
I believe this speech was like the height of hypocrisy, and that it will just create that much more hatred around the world, which will create more terrorist acts. And I believe that George Bush is the most hated man in the world, and that we're the most hated country.
You did not hear an idealistic appeal for freedom around the world in his speech today?
Well, I heard the words, and it just made me think of one of their slogan meisters, I think, is Luntz. His mantra being...
Frank Luntz, I think you're talking about, yes.
Could be. And he says, perception is reality. If they're not voting for what you want, then you just change the words and then do what you want as far as money and power. I just see it as marketing, as PR.
Spin, in other words.
The voters being consumers.
HB, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about the president's inauguration speech earlier today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. 115 groups are participating in the inaugural parade today, from the Stars and Steeds Mounted Drill Team of Willard, Missouri, to the New York City Fire Department's Emerald Society Pipes and Drum Corps. And after a very long bus ride, the Zuni Pueblo Band marches today to represent this great state of New Mexico and their Native American nation. Joining us now from the parade route is the leader of the band, Mark Romancito. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
We're checking in with participants today along the inaugural parade. What's the scene there like?
Oh, it's pretty busy. High security and everything. We just went through security and grabbing something to eat before we go to the mall.
It must be quite a challenge to take a marching band through security.
Yes, it was, especially with all our jewelry that comes from home. Our uniform is as part of our native jewelry that our Zuni people make in New Mexico, and that's part of our uniform. So the buzzers were really buzzing.
Tell us a little bit about the Zuni Pueblo Band.
Well, we're a community band. We're a self-supportive band that came together, musicians from our Zuni Pueblo. It's a Native American community down in southwest New Mexico. And this band came together back in the 1950s, and it's basically tribal members that are interested in playing music. We march. We played a lot of the traditional marches from John Philip Sousa, K.L. Sousa, and John K.L. King,
mm-hmm.
and we've been together as a band since sometime in the 1950s.
And
it's all ranging in age from 10 years old up to 70. Our eldest band member couldn't make it because he was ill and sick. And we're from a small committee and one of the very, very few Native American marching groups.
How many of you are there?
We have brought 37 people, two assistants. And the rest of them are like two majorettes, two banner carriers, myself as a drum major, and 29 band members.
It's obviously an honor to march in the inaugural parade, but that sounds like two busloads of people you had to bring all the way from New Mexico. It must be a fundraising nightmare.
Yes, we had fundraisers, and fortunately our own tribal council was good in helping to pay for our bus, but we did fundraisers like did a roadblock to raise money, getting collections, and then did a raffle. We did bake sales. We did donation drives, writing letters and trying to get donations from so many different people. And Senator Domenici's staff helped in contacting people that possibly could donate, and then radio announcements, TV program announcements in the state. So we just got a lot of donations to help from our community. Our own community people really helped us a lot, and we were very thankful for that.
Well, now that you're in Washington, briefly, are you going to stick around for a couple of days?
Well, basically, we're going to do the parade today, and like we said, we come from donations and support, very low budget, so what we're going to do is do the parade, do a little shopping tonight, and then tomorrow morning, do the sightseeing around the mall and stuff, and leave around about 2 o'clock, back for home.
Have a great time on the parade today, and have a safe trip home.
Thank you very much.
Mark Romancito is the leader of the Zuni Pueblo Band, which will be marching in today's inaugural parade. When we come back from a short break, we'll check back in on the parade route and talk about American public opinion today. What are your hopes and concerns for the next 4 years? Republicans, your line is 800-344-3893. Democrats can call 800-344-3864. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Bush celebrates his second inauguration today here in Washington, D.C. What are you doing? Throwing a party? Having a protest? Give us a phone call. Republicans, 800-344-3893. Again, that's 800-344-3893. Democrats, 800-344-3864. Again, 800-344-3864 for Democrats. NPR's Larry Abramson joins us now along the parade route, the inaugural route. And Larry, there have been, as well as celebrations, a lot of protests today.
There are a lot of protests, and you can hear them behind me, and they're very loud. And I think we're going to have dueling loudspeakers in a few moments, because as the parade begins to pass by, the loudspeakers on the other side of the street are going to tell us to please clap for the delegation from California, and then the loudspeakers on our side of the street are going to urge that President Bush be impeached. So we'll see how that goes. They're trying to make as much noise as they can.
And exactly, is this the group that got the seats along the inauguration route itself?
Yes, it was quite a legal battle. This is the Answer Coalition. It's kind of an amalgam of different groups supporting different things. They have been trying to stage a demonstration that would be visible all along the parade route, but the Park Service only gave them this one designated spot. They fought that in court, and they didn't win everything that they wanted, but they did get a little grandstand here with a couple hundred people in it, and they're got as many signs in there as they can. They're hoping that when the president passes by for those few brief moments that he will see them. And they're, you know, doing the best they can, but they are kind of corralled into a relatively small space, so they're not going to have the same impact as the supporters of the president who are stretched all along Pennsylvania Avenue.
How are the police dealing with them, and how are they getting along with those who don't share their views?
Well, it's actually, there really haven't been any encounters. I mean, the protesters are only allowed to stay in this one designated area. I think there might be a few up and down the street, but the large group is here. You can't really leave, even to go to the bathroom very easily, without losing your place and risking not getting back in line. There is a phalanx of policemen from all across the country lining the street and bicycle racks preventing anybody from moving outside of this area. So there really haven't been any confrontations. Some Bush supporters did, I think, accidentally end up walking through this area, and they did get shouted at and told that they were, rich fat cats and that sort of thing, and they sneered back. But that's about as confrontational as it got. I don't think, it doesn't seem like anybody here is interested in causing a fight, but we'll see if that changes when the president's limo passes by. In the past demonstration, the past inauguration in 2001, that's when I think an egg and a few apples flew.
You mentioned this is the Answer Coalition, just one of many protest groups holding demonstrations in various parts of town today. We should not imply that this is the only protest. There was a die-in held by some groups elsewhere in Washington, and bicyclists protesting that the streets belong to them as well. So a lot of different things going on here in Washington today, Larry.
That's right. And this demonstration that you can hear behind me, I think it's fair to say it's pretty left-wing. I mean, they're supporting solidarity with Cuba and ending the occupation not only in Iraq but also in Palestine. And I've met a lot more moderate, middle-of-the-road people who are supporting Hillary Clinton for president in 2008, people who just want any Democrat in 2008. But they're not the actual organizers of these protests. Some of them just sort of showed up to express their opinion.
It's probably fair to point out this particular group, Answer, would have been there had John Kerry been elected president.
That's right. They're against some of the establishment, basically, against some of the standard practices of this country, against what they call the plutocracy, rule by the rich, rule by corporations, and they were planning to do this, as you said, no matter who won. I think they would have had probably different chants ginned up if it had been President Kerry.
Larry Abramson, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you, Neil.
NPR's Larry Abramson joined us. He's with the protesters that are sitting in bleachers along the parade route along Pennsylvania Avenue. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Kevin, and Kevin's with us from Santa Rosa, California, calling on the Democrat line.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you, Neil?
Very well. How are you today?
Doing great, thanks.
So what are you doing today to mark the inauguration?
I'm participating in the Not One Damn Dime Day, not doing any consumer activities at all, which is really tough. But after the election, feeling really helpless and hopeless and like my voice wasn't heard, this is one way I can do it.
And I gather the protest is exactly what it says. You're not spending any money.
Not a dime. And it was real hard not to get my cup of coffee on the way to work this morning or to get my gas. But you know what? For 24 hours, I can do it.
Nevertheless, did you think, though, you spent money that you had in the gas tank?
Well, I know, but there's a way of saying that I'm not going to participate today. I'm not going to do an exchange today. So I think, it's small, Neil, but somehow I have to say this our administration is really frightening, and there's no other way to do it. So there's a lot of us doing this today, and I hope it'll make some kind of impact, at least to say, you know what, we're not supporting you.
Yep.
And I'll go back to my local wonderful bakery tomorrow and buy my coffee, but today I needed to make a statement.
Well, maybe a double tomorrow.
Yeah, you got that.
Thanks very much, Kevin.
Thank you, Neil. Bye-bye.
As President Bush begins his second term, his agenda appears both far-reaching and ambitious. Democracy in Iraq and the greater Middle East, Social Security reform, tax and tort changes. But while many may wish the president well today, the numbers suggest his policies and plans may be hard to sell. His approval rating sits at just 50%, according to a new poll that's been published by the Pew Research Center for People and the Press, and that number is considerably lower than other recent second-term presidents. Joining us now to help sort through these numbers is Andy Coat, director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Andy, it's always good to talk with you.
Hi, Neil. I'm glad to be here.
Often after an election, the president gets sort of a second honeymoon after a second inauguration. That's not happening this time.
That's not the case here. Democrats are not forgiving and forgetting the tough election campaign. Their sharp differences with the president and the Republicans. You know, many times the campaign in 2004 was characterized as each side thinking the sky would fall if the other guy was elected. Well, for Democrats, the sky has fallen. That's why we only have 17% saying that they approve of President Bush as he starts his second term. And back in 1997, Clinton was not the apple of the eye of Republicans, but as many as a third of Republicans, or a little more than a third of Republicans, said they approved. So there are even harder feelings now with Democrats than there were then, and in the case of most other presidents. So the president has his work cut out for him. He has to keep his strong Republican support, and he has to worry about the independents who are in the middle. And the independents differ with him on priorities.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that 17% approval. That's among Democrats.
Right, that's among Democrats.
That's obviously correct. Doing much better among Republicans.
90%.
Yeah. Now, the president says he did win solid majorities in both the Electoral College and the popular vote this time around. But he's said he's got, as a result of that, mandates for some of his policies. Yet, according to your poll, some of the things that he's pushing, Social Security reform, tax reform, are not the top of the public's agenda.
Well, certainly making tax cuts permanent, legal reforms, changing, reforming the tax system get relatively low priorities. Social Security does get pretty high priorities, although there's more urgency with respect to fixing the health care system. With Social Security, the issue is how. And there's really no consensus. There's a lot of support for the president's idea about privatizing it for younger voters, but people are still concerned that the system protect them, even though they're in the free market.
Mm-hmm. Divisions on those issues, divisions on the war as well?
Well, the war continues to be divisive. The public is divided about 50-50 about whether it was the right thing or the wrong thing to do. Republicans and Democrats look at that situation in Iraq and they come away with different perceptions. Republicans say things, things are going reasonably well. Democrats say things are going terribly. This is not going well at all. And the public is aware of the elections, and there's a lot of hope that the elections,
the Iraqi elections,
and there's a lot of hope that things will improve, a course out of there will emerge, but there's a lot of skepticism about that on the part of the public generally.
Mm-hmm. Now, Republicans tend to see the war on terrorism and the war in Iraq as one issue. Democrats do not. But just on the terrorism issue, is there as much partisan divide on that as well?
Well, the Republicans are the hawks. You know, we've got back, remember in the Vietnam era, we used to have hawks and doves. Now we have hawks and doves in the war on terrorism. Republicans support the concept of preemption. Democrats oppose it, both to greater degrees in each direction than they did before the war in Iraq. The war in Iraq has further divided Republicans and Democrats on how to conduct this war on terrorism. Now, of course, everyone wants to protect the country from terrorism. The question is how and to what extent we're willing to sacrifice or curtail civil liberties. And there are big divides on these questions. That's part of the challenge for President Bush. He's got a public that doesn't agree about how to deal with these big issues, whether it's Social Security or furthering the war on terrorism.
Just anecdotal, of course, but we're hearing from some Republicans that the president reached out today. We're not hearing the same thing from Democrats. There could, if you test that later, be divides on that. But what does the public expect in terms of partisanship in Washington?
Well, the public has expected for some time a great deal of partisanship, but the percentages are even greater this year, saying that the Republicans and Democrats are going to have at it and not achieve a lot. And on the part of Democrats, the Democrats have been disappointed with the leadership of their party, and many of them are going to want to see the Democrats not stand up to President Bush and the Republicans. The Republicans, on the other hand, want to see their administration achieve its goals, and the independents are going to fall somewhere in between.
So if the public's perceptions are realized, it's going to be a tough 4 years.
It's going to be a tough 4 years, and it's not even, we're not talking 4 years, we're talking 2 years, because the midterm elections are going to roll around pretty soon, and the Bush administration is going to be judged on the basis of how much progress it's making as people think about their choices for Congress and Senate in a relatively short period. And that will be the perception of how well the president is doing is going to be awfully important to Republican candidates.
And, of course, we always have to remember that none of us can predict the future. 4 years ago, we would not have anticipated the events of 9/11 that transformed everything, including public opinion and politics.
That's right. And if we look back at every second term, we'd have to go all the way back to Eisenhower not to find a second term that wasn't marred by some scandal. I'm not saying there's going to be a scandal, but these second terms almost seem destined to have problems.
Andy Kohut, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And Robbie's with us on the Republican line from Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I just think, you know, as I'm listening to the show, you hear people calling in on both sides who just seem so frustrated and angry, like they can almost just cry or just go ballistic on something. But, you know, I think it just comes down to, as American, you know, nation, we have to understand that we're a group of a bunch of different people who, you know, sometimes it's hard to meet in the middle, but we really need to try and work together to find solutions to a lot of our problems.
Did you hear the president reaching out to the middle today in his speech?
You know, I didn't hear the whole speech because I'm in and out between work. But a lot of the things that, you know, I hear a lot, you know, I've heard a lot. I mean, I think that he is willing to try this term. And I think that, you know, both sides need to give a little and to get a little. I mean, quite honestly.
So you're an optimist.
I am.
Robbie, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Let's go now to the Democratic line, and this is Mark, and Mark's calling from Minneapolis.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I have to say I was sad listening to the speech today. As a gay American, I think, boy, I'm not hopeful. I don't see how Mr. Bush is going to pull this off when he's asking us to come together, when I, as an advantaged white American, feel that the tyranny exists here in my country through the president. he talks about discrimination, freedom, justice. Well, I'm experiencing discrimination and injustice from the Republican administration.
Yeah, Mark, we're having a problem with your phone line. I did want to ask, though, the president in his speech appealed, reached out to minorities, talked about the baggage of bigotry and the need to erase racism. He spoke to, in scriptural references, to Jews, to Christians, and to Muslims. You don't feel he reached out at all to you?
I think he's reached out in a bullying way through constitutional amendments.
Mark, thanks very much. I apologize for the quality of the phone line, but we appreciate the call today. Andy Kohut, Mark was talking about some of the issues that certainly presented themselves in the campaigns, 11 constitutional amendments in various states around the country on gay marriage in this past election. How does that issue continue to test?
Well, it continues to be one in which the American public is strongly opposed, strong majorities opposed to gay marriages, yet there's a general trend in terms of more acceptance of homosexuality in the United States. But gay marriage is a place that most Americans won't go in terms of giving their support. And I think it's going to be an issue that will continue to divide the country. One of the things that exists, however, is a huge generation gap. Younger people have a very different view than older and middle-aged people. So this is an issue that will be with us over time, mm-hmm. and opinions overall may change as the population changes, but it's certainly a divisive one now.
In his speech today, the president did reach out specifically in a call to young people to perform public service. Young people were one demographic group that did not support the president in this past election. Do you break down your age groups in terms of supporting the president or not?
Well, certainly that's true. The young voters were the only group in which President Bush didn't do, one of the few groups in which President Bush did not do better than he did 4 years ago, and young voters continue to be more skeptical about the president, and so do older voters. One of the things that we did in this poll, as we do every 4 years, is we ask people which groups are going to gain and lose influence in the coming 4 years, and people thought to lose influence it will include environmentalists, union leaders, and poor people. Not too surprising in a Republican administration, but a plurality of people thought that older people are going to lose influence in Washington in the second term. And that may be some sense that Social Security, there might be a real fight about Social Security, and Social Security changes may not benefit seniors. So it's not only young people. We have issues with the Bush administration at both ends of the age spectrum.
Andy Kohut, as always, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Andy Kohut is director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. Of course, stay tuned to NPR News throughout the day for continuing coverage of the inauguration, the parade, and the events later this evening. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.